We always have so many things to tell our audience about here at Intelligence Squared. So when I'm needing a top-down view of it all, I don't want to feel like I'm looking at organized chaos. That's why I really love Notion, which lays out different threads of work in a beautifully designed layout. And despite all of its clever AI tech going on in the background, it feels as clear and easy as putting pen to paper. Remember that? But with Notion, you can do a lot more than jot down a few thoughts. Notion is a place where any team can write, plan, organize, and rediscover the joy of play. And thanks to its AI-powered model, the way it works is so intuitive, every question has an answer. I still love my paper notebook, but sitting next to Notion, it might need to up its game a little bit. Try Notion for free and up your game too when you go to notion.com/squared. That's all lowercase letters, notion.com/squared, lowercase. So you can start turning ideas into action. And when you use the link, you're supporting Intelligence Squared too. That's notion.com/squared.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm producer Catherine Hughes. To mark International Women's Day, we're dedicating all 7 days this week to examining the challenges and triumphs of women around the world through art, sports, literature, and politics. To round off this special week of programming, we're bringing you this final thought-provoking conversation about who defines feminism. Often in the Western world, to help understand the history of feminism, we refer to the model of different waves, which sets out to define the trajectory of certain fights and milestones, such as the right to vote and access to contraception. But what does this version of history include, and who does it exclude? In this discussion, Professor Lucy Delap and Trita Lakhani discuss the societal structures around the world which have oppressed women throughout history, as well as the intersection of the state and feminism, and the need to recognise the pluralistic nature of feminism in order to achieve a better future for everyone. Our host for this conversation is broadcaster and academic Philippa Thomas. Here's Philippa with more.
Today we're delving into the fascinating and complex history of feminism, examining the different waves of the movement and the achievements that it's brought for women. At the same time, we're also acknowledging the challenges that feminism has faced and the people it hasn't always included. The achievements have been many, including the right to vote, increased access to education and employment opportunities, the legalization of birth control and abortion. The challenges have also been many, resistance and opposition from without and division within, not least from this sprawling movement's internal systemic failings and divisions. Well, to discuss all of this and more, I'm joined today by Lucy Delap, who is Professor in Modern British and Gender History at the University of Cambridge. Lucy is a Fellow of Murray Edwards College. And Trita Lakhani, Researcher and Educator at the SOAS University of London's Centre for Gender Studies. Lucy, Trita, welcome to Intelligence Squared. And Lucy, if I can begin with you, even defining feminism is problematic, is open to different interpretations. And the metaphor that we're choosing to explore today for Intelligence Squared is that of waves of feminism. And I would like us to explore together the different waves and how they are commonly understood and what they've left out. But first, can I come to you for your thoughts on that metaphor, that way of approaching the history of feminism?
The wave metaphor does quite a lot of work for us, and it's really helpful to have a way of kind of reaching back historically and thinking about the different questions feminists might have been asking. That's obviously helpful when people ask for a definition, because we'll always have to say, well, it meant different things in different time periods. But the problem with the wave metaphor is it's almost doing too much work. So it tends to make us look at specific moments. So for example, the Seneca Falls Conference in the United States in the 19th century, or we might look to the militant suffragists in Britain in the early 20th century. Those seem to be kind of, you know, founding wave moments. But we don't look in between, and we miss a lot of the richness of different kinds of feminist activism And in particular, I think the waves metaphor tends to make us look to the United States or to Europe, and we don't therefore get a sense of the kind of the global diversity of women's activisms around gender justice. So the wave metaphor definitely like directs our gaze too strongly to specific places. And it also makes us feel as though everyone at those moments of wave, kind of the waves crashing in on the beach, as if they all agreed with each other. Whereas actually, even at those moments of kind of peak wave activism, there were lots of different interpretations at play, and women don't necessarily agree on what the goal should be.
I think that Lucy kind of very much put it perfectly. When we look at the wave metaphor, we kind of forget to look at who's defining the waves and who's defining feminism. And by even defining what feminism is, we're also defining what womanhood is and who gets access to feminism, whose voices are heard and whose histories are heard. And when we look at the waves in particular, we see a huge marginalization of feminist thought, feminist activity that happened outside of the West, especially in the global South or against like the empire. But also we forget some of the complicities and the collusions of some of the very women fighting for feminist or women's liberation in the West, who were also complicit in, especially in the first wave and the second wave, in empire and colonization and the active oppression of people around the world as well. So the wave metaphor invisibilizes almost other forms of thinking about feminism and narrows feminism to this idea of just for gender equality rather than seeing feminism as a form of justice work.
And the last thing I want to do is narrow the debate. So what I'm suggesting that we do over this half hour or so is articulate a little more clearly what the different waves in the model are seen as represented, what's agreed about them, and their landmark moments, and then come back to where they may fail us, who they may exclude, and who gets to decide and define today. If we're looking at some of the key turning points in the history of feminism, Lucy, can I come back to you first on perhaps the easiest wave to talk about, perhaps the first, and the right to vote?
There's nothing easy about the right to vote okay. As a starting point, yeah. because we could put it back to the early 19th century and the kind of extraordinary ferment that came in the wake of the Haitian, the American, and the French revolutions. They set up ideas about who should speak, who could be a citizen, what a constitution looked like, what a acceptable system of authority should be, that just gave so many opportunities for people to think differently, whether that was the utopian socialists who were creating new communities that rejected ideas of marriage and property, or whether it was, you know, ideas around voting that spanned really contentious questions around like racial exclusion and enslavement. I mean, you know, there's a ferment of ideas there. So the kind of typical starting point, right? 1848, the Seneca Falls Conference, where white women, predominantly white women, got together to discuss women's voting rights in the United States. That's just one possible starting point amongst many. And there's no particular reason why we should start in the US when, you know, the extraordinary things were happening in other parts of the world where both women and men were contesting women's exclusion. Think about the, you know, the kind of the world turned on its head in Saint-Domingue or Haiti, where like the existing power structures were being completely overturned. So yeah, I don't think there's a kind of clear starting point to the first wave. But for the sake of our conversation, let's start with the right to vote and the claims that were newly being made around women's right to vote. On what basis were those claims being made? On the basis of sometimes things that don't really add up to our present day assumptions of what feminism might look like. So women were sometimes calling for enfranchisement on the basis of property. And that was not a particularly radical idea because it was essentially saying, well, the status quo might stay the same, but propertied women should be part of the citizenship body. But that was also being contested at the time by people who were saying, no, it's on the basis of your human existence that you should be enfranchised. So some quite radical calls for the vote, and then some quite kind of socially conservative calls for vote in the 19th century.
And I meant easier to define in retrospect rather than easier to achieve. But even that is problematic, as you've pointed out. And Shrita, that idea of who are the first feminists, even the where did it begin question, is huge and devolving in itself.
I mean, it really is. And I don't think there is an answer to it, kind of as Lucy has pointed out, because even what does feminism mean is different from person to person. But I think that the point Lucy made around who is predominantly seen as part of the first wave is important to think about, because it does also tell us a lot about the kind of movement that was happening at that moment in time, in particular highlighting that it was mostly white women of a certain class that were predominantly talking about having access to voting, right? And so there's an entire class element as well. And therefore, we're seeing womanhood being defined in that particular moment in that group of people as white and as upper class, right? And if you didn't have access to those, you weren't necessarily seen as a woman or seen as someone that should have the right to vote in the first place, or even seen as someone that had a viewpoint.
So that cloud of hierarchy kind of hangs over us from the beginning. I mean, when you say that, Shrita, it makes me think when I am in conversations about inclusive practices in the workplace today, what often gets missed out is the economic, is class, you know, whether we're talking about the UK, the US or beyond.
Sometimes some of the splits that we need to look at historically are not so familiar to us today. So, for example, in the 19th century, there's a big debate about should single women have the vote because they don't have a male relative who can kind of represent them, or should married women have the vote because they represent the kind of fulfillment of conservative ideas of femininity, right? They're good wives, they're good mothers, and therefore they're the best citizens. So there's some really interesting debates that don't necessarily correspond to what we think are important today. But I would also say that we've started with the vote almost because it's a kind of like, it seems like a fundamental building block. But there's another way of looking at it, which is to say that the vote was a relatively small ask that everyone could agree on. And there were other issues that were really dividing feminist activism at the time. So, for example, the divide over should the state intervene to protect working women from the kind of worst abuses of employment in industrializing countries. Women were exploited by working with dangerous chemicals, very, very long hours, unsafe factories, night work. It was really, really tough for working class women in, you know, 19th century factories all over the world. So, you know, there was a very divided debate on this where more privileged women often said they should have a free market for their labor. They should be allowed to work anywhere, and that's the best way for them to achieve emancipation and self-support. Whereas quite a lot of activists in working class organizations said, no, the best thing to do would be to either get unions or the state to bring in like bans on women from working at night, or bans on women for working when they're pregnant or with dangerous chemicals. So, you know, this was not an easy issue on which to find agreement. And the vote was a kind of a glue that glued together these disparate elements of the women's movement and provided a kind of focal point on which everyone could agree briefly.
And as we're talking about the role of the state or the role of legislation in looking at the lot of women, Lucy, take us into what's understood to be second wave feminism.
Second wave feminism is commonly understood as coming at the sort of mid to late period of the 20th century. Sometimes we call it like post-68 feminism because it was so rooted in the kind of the rise of the counterculture, the new left, the peace movement, the people opposing the Vietnam War, the kind of left-wing student movement and so on. All of those movements had these like very exciting new ways of doing politics. And lots of women got really engaged in them, but also found that they were doing so on a kind of second rank basis. They were often expected to make the tea and have sex with radical revolutionary men. And they found this to be very unsatisfying. And they developed their own critiques, which came together in a movement that in some parts of the world was known as the Women's Liberation Movement. And I would say it's really different from the first wave, so-called, if we take the first wave as a suffrage wave, because it was much more sharply directed against men and, you know, forming a critique of men. Whereas in the first wave period, the emphasis was more on asking for rights from the state. Now, those are kind of very like broad brush characterizations, but certainly the women's liberation movement experimented with things that you don't really see that much in the first wave, like women only working with other women and working in these kind of very grassrootsy activated ways that extended politics into the bedroom, into the kitchen, into the workplace, and at that very micro level of kind of almost micro injuries, refused to accept objectification and sexual harassment and workplace inequalities and contested who was going to do the washing up. And, you know, this went with huge social transformation in terms of divorces and women walking away from abusive or unsatisfactory marriages. So it was kind of like a huge social upheaval at that very grassroots level.
And Shrita, what do you make of the way the conversation changed then? We're talking history, aren't we? But we are talking about that growing awareness of systems, of patriarchy, of capitalism, and that pervasive impact.
Personally, I really find the second wave really exciting to think about, and not necessarily in this metaphor of waves that we're using, but more about like the conversations that came about during that period, the organizing that was happening as well, in that like we had feminist organizing that wasn't organizing on single issue politics. There was organizing happening across the board, and there was coalitions happening, while also understanding how women, and in particular women of color, were still being marginalized from the very spaces where they were actively organizing and doing a lot of the care work to reproduce organizing in itself. And this is the period where we saw Black feminist thought, especially in the US, but outside of the US, really pick up. And like today, we still see influences of those thoughts in our organizing, especially when we think about intersectionality or ideas of interlocking forms of oppression, or understanding that the systems of oppression, while we experience oppression differently, the systems are connected. And we can still see the influence of that kind of thought process in activist movements today and in some of our thinking and teaching today.
And Shrita, intersectionality is a word that brings third wave feminism to mind for me. But how would you describe that? You just said something about interlocking forms of oppression, but can you tell us more about your understanding of what that means?
So the reason I associate intersectionality not just to the third wave, but to the second wave itself as well, is because it didn't come out of a vacuum, right? We often associate intersectionality to Kimberly Crenshaw, but she herself has said that that idea of interlocking forms of oppression, she like has happened before and has been talked about by the Third Woman Alliance, by the Combahee River Collective. We've seen that idea come about in different forms by lots of other Black feminist thinkers and organizers, but it's just the one that's kind of been picked up, and we've seen it almost, I think, diluted from its initial idea in the way it's been used almost for everything as a tick box, almost, when we think of intersectionality. But to answer your question, sorry, I started with a tangent. I guess when I think of intersectionality, I see it as both like a theoretical but also methodological tool that kind of helps us understand how there are different forms of oppressions which are intersecting, and that we can't understand gender, racism, classism, or oppression due to sexuality as different forms of oppressions that are not interconnected. So intersectionality asks us to see how these different forms of oppressions are interconnected, and how therefore we experience violence in different ways due to sometimes the multiple forms of exploitation that we kind of experience.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents with the code squared. Simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code squared to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV.
Professor Delap, what comes to mind for you as being most of value about the concept of intersectionality?
It's really turbocharged our understanding of like how people experience oppressions. And I think it helps us in a kind of larger project of pluralization, of recognizing that there's not going to be one descriptor or kind of definition of what justice might mean when we think about the intersecting experiences of, as Shrita said, of racialization, of ableism, of homophobia. All these things play out together. And for me as a historian, I'm always fascinated by those resonances with earlier periods. And I would push back even, you know, well beyond the sort of second half of the 20th century into the 19th century. Sojourner Truth, who was a famous formerly enslaved woman who became one of the advocates for abolition. She famously showed her breast at an abolitionist meeting and said, "Ain't I a woman?" Pointing out that the kind of claims that white women were making on behalf of their womanhood were also experienced, and it was a language that she could use as a black woman and a formerly enslaved woman, but that it might mean something different for her. So she really raised in an incredibly powerful way that question of the intersections of race and gender, and we've expanded that as we go through into the 21st century with a kind of wider recognition of all these different intersecting axes, or what Patricia Hill Collins calls the matrix of oppression. So there's been so many people who've added to this really rich conversation about intersection, interlocking oppressions. And it's made the history of feminisms into a much richer affair to recognize that so many people have brought their experiences and brought different needs and different questions to the table, which is, again, to come round again to the wave metaphor, why that metaphor is so flattening and so difficult for us if we're trying to tell that fuller story.
And that expanding you talk about made me think about, even, you know, in the last few weeks, we've been talking again about the inclusion of trans rights, the debate in Scotland, that these widening of debate, widening of parameters of reference that may have begun with what we're calling the third wave, we're still trying to define what it means and what that means for a responsible feminist today.
I mean, completely. I think that like the idea of intersectionality at least gives us the platform to understand that there's different kinds of feminisms and there's different kinds of solutions, and that there isn't just a one fits all method to justice work or like feminist movement building. But like I said earlier, what I find really interesting around when we're thinking about feminist movements is if you speak to most feminists, they will tell you that feminism is undefinable. It's about doing justice work. And I like to pay attention to who tries to define what feminism is and who has access to feminism. And now you kind of mentioned transphobia, and what we're seeing is, and it's always existed, but a group of people trying to define what feminism is and who feminism is for. And they, by doing this defining, they're not only are they actively excluding trans women and non-binary people, but they are fundamentally encouraging violence towards trans women and non-binary people and women of color as well. When you think about like the idea of who has had access to womanhood in the past, it hasn't been women of color or Black women. And we've seen that like being thrown out multiple times. When you think about like Michelle Obama and some of the abuse she got, a lot of it had to do with a lot of people on the internet saying she wasn't a woman. And therefore, the idea of womanhood is already quite particular. And therefore, when you see people trying to define feminism, they're also trying to define womanhood. And it tends to be for a particular political purpose rather than for justice work.
Yeah, I totally agree, Shrita. And building on that, I want to raise the question of who can do feminism, if you like, or who can engage in justice work and put men back in there. Because I do think that the kind of the responses, the kind of transphobic responses that deny the presence of trans women in the movement are also, in effect, denying the longstanding sense in which people of all genders and non-binary people can be part of this movement. And I mentioned earlier that it's characteristic of the kind of post-68 moment that there's a kind of sharper critique of men. But I also think that's a really exciting time where men are building on actually earlier generations to say, well, men need to be part of this solution. They need to be part of the debate. They must respect women's perspectives and you know, sort of, you know, listen to them and be accountable to them. But men also have got work to do in thinking about their socialization, their emotional fragility or inadequacy, their parenting work, their care work, their violence and their aggressive behavior towards women. You know, it's super exciting when you get a kind of feminist activism that also invites men to the table. And that isn't only in the late 20th century, because you also get it in the suffrage era that we talked about previously, where men are quite active on behalf of women's claims to citizenship and to voting rights. And I would say throughout the anti-colonial struggles, where often there's been forms of feminist activism that are very closely allied with nationalist or anti-colonial movements where men are very central. So if we widen our range a little bit in feminist history, we get a lot more involvement of really interesting men, men like Frederick Douglass, the US abolitionist, men like Jose Marti in the Cuban context, Cuban nationalist, movements where men have really been invited in and placed very centrally, such as in the wonderful organization Women in Nigeria, which made it always an invitation for men to be part of that movement and to be part of the struggle around Nigerian women's rights.
At this point, I have to say, me too. The fourth, if we're talking about the wave metaphor, the fourth wave, me too, and the pushback against sexualized violence and assumptions and behavior towards women. I mean, that's something where, in a way, you're coming back to earlier times and the men are the enemy kind of idea or trope. And there's also a very open question about, okay, what do men do here as part of the movement and allies of the movement? Shrita Lakhani, what are your thoughts on how difficult it is to be a feminist man in today's feminist environment?
I think being a feminist is always going to be difficult and uncomfortable. And if it's not, then we have a problem, right? Because feminism is all about building a better society. And that requires us to be reflexive of some of our participation in the very structures that causes violence towards women, non-binary people as well. And so I have to say, like, I think it's uncomfortable and difficult to be a feminist regardless of your gender because it requires us to do a lot of work.
But if you're trying to change structures and systems, you surely need to include as much as possible, which is why I'm bringing up men.
I mean, I completely agree. I think that we need to include men and we need to include everyone in the feminist movement to change the structures, which is why a part of me really is drawn to abolition feminism. And I'm happy to talk about abolition feminism a little bit later. But you mentioned the Me Too movement in particular, and I think the Me Too movement is a very interesting movement or moment that happened because it's so tied to the kind of divide we have in feminism today, which is one which is very much rooted in neoliberal ideas and the other which is slightly more radical. And Me Too stems from a lot of neoliberal ideas around feminism, which doesn't necessarily call for an overhauling of the system, but it kind of gives you the idea that inequality can be overcome through the state and the corporate environments. And therefore, we're having women call for the criminalization and the jailing of men that have committed violence rather than thinking about patriarchy as a whole and the forms of violence that create the environment for sexual harassment and gendered violence in the first place, and we're not thinking about care or repair.
I would like to hear both of your thoughts on abolitionist feminism. Sreeta, would you define it if you can? It's hard in a nutshell, that, isn't it? But can you define what you mean by it for our audience?
I might start with what is abolition first. So at least abolition is seen as a political vision, a form of structural analysis of oppression and practical organizing strategy that kind of changes the way we structure our society. And instead of structuring our society around punishment and violence, it encourages us to kind of build a society around care. And so quite often people think abolition is about just getting rid of the police. Right? But abolition is so much more than that. It's about rethinking how we deal with social issues from the ground up. It kind of asks us, what are we prioritizing in terms of funding? So it kind of says mental health care shouldn't be about criminalizing people and putting them in prisons. It should be about building proper resources. We should have more social support rather than harassing homeless people and letting them be homeless on the street. It's about thinking about when there is acts of gendered or sexual violence, how can we center with care the survivor rather than the perpetrator, which is what the current form of system does. And it also acknowledges that the systems we have, which is the police, the border, and the state, how they enact violence continuously on lots of groups of people, which is gendered, racialized, sexualized, and classed. And it kind of calls for a coalition between different groups of organizing, which includes feminist organizing as well.
Lucy, does abolitionism enrich the debate for you or not?
I think as a historian who's done a lot of work on the sort of 60s, 70s, and 80s, what strikes me about that period is that the kind of debate about what should the state be doing is less prominent. And it's a period where there's a lot of kind of DIY solutions and activism, which is bypassing the question of state resources and talking about building from the community up. So in that period where we're talking about, say, experiences of violence and particularly sexual assault and sexual violence, the debate is all about how can the women's movement build resources for victims and survivors of sexual violence? And that's when you get all the fantastic refuges and helplines and support groups setting up. They sometimes have their own sort of inbuilt exclusions. So there's a story to be had about, you know, is there a kind of racism problem in some of those shelters that you see in Australia or the United States or the UK? There is. But I think it's a very productive moment where instead of like constantly turning to the state for action, people are asking, well, what can I do? And to come back to this question of kind of Me Too and where men should be in this story, well, men are part of that answer. They're not just the perpetrators. Sometimes they're the activists who are helping to support as creche workers or as fundraisers or as, you know, various different kind of support roles. But men are also initiating conversations amongst themselves about violence and looking deeply at their lives to ask, what kind of socialization leads to pervasive forms of violence? How do men benefit from violence? But also, how could men be beneficiaries from challenging patriarchal violence? And how could they live fuller lives in closer dialogue with women and children and other men? So, you know, you get actually quite a positive story there of a sort of a virtuous spiral whereby men's activism and women's activism can all sort of, you know, interlock to create better outcomes for all. So in that sense, it's quite utopian. And I'd like to kind of rediscover some of that utopian energy in thinking about how we can build a less violent society.
Shrita, where do you draw your hope from?
I do draw my hope from abolition feminism precisely because it doesn't look at the state for an answer. It looks at finding answers in our communities, in our grassroots work, but also because it offers us a space to actually connect different struggles together and build a movement that, in my opinion, can actually mean freedom for all and liberation for all rather than just a few. Which is why I get a lot of hope from abolition feminism. I think it's one of the first spaces which I have personally seen that doesn't encounter as many exclusions as other forms of feminist organizing may have had in the past.
I wonder whether in the future, 20, 30 years from now, we'll be saying abolitionist feminism was the fifth wave. Do you think, Lucy, we will be talking about a fifth, sixth, seventh wave? Do you hope we do or don't?
I'm a little skeptical about like the proliferation of waves. I mean, I suppose the nature of the metaphor of waves is that they keep crashing in on the beach. I actually prefer the metaphor of radio waves, which a historian called Nancy Hewitt came up with as a way of thinking about like the kind of simultaneous struggles, the intersecting struggles that Trita's talked about, where the radio waves talks to us nicely about these voices that are kind of being simultaneously broadcast. And sometimes some of them are strong, some of them are weak signals, some of them kind of dissolve into static, some of them are creative and full of music, others are kind of strident and violent. And I like that sense of the radio as a kind of richer metaphor for understanding the kind of plurality of feminisms. But going forward, what will we be saying about our kind of contemporary moment and the activism that it shows? I think it's a time when there's an incredible vitality of feminist activism that's coming from the global south. And when we look at the struggle against forms of violence, whether they're state-sponsored or whether they are sort of on an everyday quotidian basis, I think that the kind of excitement for me lies in the massive movement that's been sweeping Latin America, Central America, South America, that has been mobilizing women to insist on reproductive rights, to campaign against male violence. I'm thinking of the Chilean movement that gave us the great like song and dance, Un Violador en tu Camino, a Rapist in Your Path, which went global, went viral, was taken up by women in Bangladesh, women in Turkey, by women in Poland, and gave this kind of incredible, you know, feminist power, powered up through a creative art intervention, powered up this struggle against violence against women.
And Shrita Lakhani, I want to give the final word to you. I'm conscious that you're both educators, you both have students, and I'm really interested to know, you know, your new students today, are they engaged as feminists? Are they excited about feminism, or do you have to sell it to them?
Personally, I teach in the Center for Gender Studies. So the people that come to the course are already excited by feminist movements and feminism. And they actually might come to the degree with like preconceptions of what feminism is. And so what's more exciting and interesting for me is to see their journey in that time space, in understanding feminism in different ways and learning about different, like different feminist movements rather than just the mainstream ones that we are exposed to. So the students that come are definitely interested in feminism, but it's exciting to see how their idea of what feminism is expanded, and how they learn from different feminist movements from around the world.
Well, I hope they'll listen to you both, and it'll expand the conversation. Shrita and Lucy, thank you. That was Shrita Lakhani and Lucy Dilap. You've been listening to Intelligence Squared. I'm Philippa Thomas, and this episode was produced and edited by Catherine Hughes. Thank you for joining us.